When I first began preparing this talk, I had a plan. I was going to talk about pain and suffering and joy and how they all kind of come together. And events of the last few days sort of overtook me. And it became clear to me that as we're talking about pain and suffering, that we have such an outstanding example of real devastation that's occurred over on the other part of the world. And it's devastation of such magnitude that it's really hard to grapple with it. It's hard to get your arms around it. It's hard to conceive of that much pain. When I printed these pages out last night, the number of dead was 70,000, and by this morning it was 100,000, and by noon it was 120,000. That's huge. And my son was in Phuket just a year ago. Could have been this year. So that's a huge amount of pain and suffering that our world is trying to grapple with and absorb. And so what I thought maybe that what I would do tonight is sort of focus a little bit on how do we hold that kind of pain. And what's clear is that everybody has pain in their lives. There are many sources of pain. There's tsunamis and earthquakes. There's the pain of losing someone we love. There's the pain of losing our job. There are feelings of inadequacy, feelings of loneliness, feelings of guilt, loss of a spouse, loss of a partner. These are all things, by the way, that I've felt. They're not theoretical. Unlike this enormous catastrophe in Southeast Asia, these are things that are happening right here and now to all of us. We have pain that we have to deal with and that we have to grapple with and that we have to somehow incorporate. And the question is, how do we hold pain, both the pain of the larger devastation and our own personal pain? And sometimes when we encounter the immense suffering of some huge devastation like from the tsunamis, we're tempted to discount our own pain as being nothing. It's just, well, I'm just feeling inadequate. But the truth is, it's only in holding our own pain and being in touch with that pain and with our own deep sorrow that we can help other people. That's the only route, actually. Otherwise, it becomes a concept. It becomes an idea instead of something that has reality for us. I want to read a poem by Naomi Shihab Nye, who's one of my favorite poets. So if you run across anything by her, you know it's going to be great. This is a poem called Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking that the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you. How he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out in the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. So what does it mean? What does it mean to hold pain and explore sorrow? Now, it sounds masochistic, doesn't it? But actually it isn't. The interesting thing about holding pain is that pain and joy are very, very close together. They both have to do with the intensity of being alive. And sometimes it's very difficult to tell when one changes over into the other, because they are, in fact, very close together. But you can only know this when you become really familiar with what's pain as opposed to suffering. So that's what I'd like to talk about. So what I'd like us to do is kind of think about pain and how it's differentiated from suffering. Pain is everywhere. It happens. Pain, however, is something that is not optional, whereas suffering can be optional. Suffering is my experience of that pain. Okay, that's the distinction I want to make, that suffering has to do with the experience of the pain, not the pain itself. So I want to make a real clear differentiation between them. The first noble truth says that suffering exists, and that the second noble truth is that the cause of suffering is craving or aversion. It doesn't say anything about pain. Pain is just there. The suffering arises because we want to push the pain away, we want to eliminate the pain. So, while there are many causes of pain, the causes of suffering are very often self-inflicted. Right? I mean, suffering arises, let's just take two things. One is fear. Often, when pain turns to suffering, it has something to do with fear. It's going to be here forever. It's never going to change. It's always going to be like this. Nobody loves me. Nobody's ever going to love me. Or we're afraid it's going to lead to something worse. Oh, I've got this pain in my back. If I don't do something about this pain in my back, you know, I'm probably going to be not able to walk. And next thing you know, I'm going to be laying in bed. I'm not going to be able to get up. It's just a pain in my back. But the fear is much greater than the pain in my back. The fear of not being able to walk is much greater than the pain in the back. Sometimes we think of it as, it's going to get worse and I'm not going to be able to stand it. And that's going to be so embarrassing, I'm going to break down right here. Somebody's going to hear me. I'm going to be in tears any moment. All of this is suffering. This doesn't have anything to do with the pain, really. It's my experience of the pain, not the pain itself. The other thing that happens besides fear is my beliefs about the pain. This happened before. I know it's going to this is what's going to happen now. Okay, the last time I didn't do anything about this pain in my back, I was in bed for a week. It's going to happen again, right? So we have these beliefs about something, or this means, well, okay, so the reason my husband left me was I'm really a shit. Now, maybe he was the shit, but that's not my belief. My belief is I did something wrong, so that's why he's gone. That part has to do with suffering. That doesn't have to do with the pain of the event. Or I'm sure the outcome of this is going to be. I know what comes from this. This is what's going to happen. This always happens. These are beliefs. They have nothing to do with the initial cause. Another one of the myths that's really prevalent, the one that I have a lot of trouble with, is I believe things about myself. Okay, I know myself really well. I've studied myself now for 56 years. I know I am this way. Well, talk about giving your freedom up. As soon as you decide I am this way and this is what's going to happen, the natural outcome of that is going to be suffering because you're giving up your freedom. You're giving up your right to be whatever you are in the moment. So very often, suffering is caused by the things that we know to be true, in quotes, or our fears about things that could be true. So I want to tell you a story. This is a story about a cave. And there was a man who was condemned to death. And he was told, he was blindfolded, and he was put in this cave. And the cave was 100 yards by 100 yards, and it had a ceiling 18 feet high. And they rolled a big stone in front of the cave to seal it. And he was told that there was a way out of the cave, and that if he could find it, he was a free man. And that for 30 days, they would lower food to him. He would get bread and water through a hole in the ceiling of the cave, this 18-foot high ceiling. So he was sealed into the cave, and he took his blindfold off. It was totally dark, but there was a little bit of light up where they lowered the food in. Now, the opening was a 1-foot diameter opening. Now, he was, 5 feet 9 inches high, and he figured he had a reach of about 2 feet, and so in order to get up to that hole, he was going to need to build something 10 feet high. So he wandered around the cave in the dark. There was no light except what was up there at the very top, and he found these rocks. And he said, okay, maybe I can build something from these rocks. So he started building a platform with the rocks and the dirt. And after 2 weeks, he had a platform that was about 6 feet high. And he said, okay, I think I can do this. I think this is going to work. I'm going to make it. After the next 2 weeks, he was up at about, 9.5 feet. But if he jumped, he could just barely reach this hole. So he was jumping for it, and he fell. Landed on the floor, and he was really exhausted. The 30 days were up. He'd been living on bread and water. Most of the platform had been dirt that he dug with his hands, and he couldn't get back up. And 2 days later, he died. And his captors went over and rolled the stone away from in front of the cave. And what you could see when they did that was a 3-foot diameter hole in the wall, not far from where he had built his platform, that led to the other side of the mountain. If he'd crawled 200 feet, he would have been a free man. But he wasn't looking in the dark. He was looking where the light was. Because he believed that where there was light, there was an opening. So I told this story to a friend of mine, and she said, but Maria, the dark is frightening. Who wants to crawl around in the dark? And it brings me back to that idea of exploring pain. Sometimes it makes a lot of sense to spend some time in the dark, to spend some time looking in those places that are uncomfortable, that you can't quite figure out, and to see what's really there. Because it may be what is really there is your ultimate freedom. So I'm suggesting that you might want to embrace the dark. Go to those places where you see pain and learn about them. Find out what's there. See how you behave. See what your reactions to them are. Find out what it really is, as opposed to what you believe about it. Because you might find that a source of pain is not so painful after all. A couple of weeks ago, I went to visit someone I'm very close to who is in prison. And it wasn't the first time I've visited this person, but I'm going to call him Paul, just so I have something to call him here. I had written a letter to him a few months ago, and I was talking to him about the fact that he had switched the place where he was because he needed to go to a place where he could take a drug rehab course, and then he would get out 6 months sooner. And so I wrote to him and I said, I hope you take advantage of that and not just use it to play the system, to work the system. And he wrote me back and said, you are so naive. I would be a fool to trust anybody in here. But the letter got him thinking about it. And so when I arrived a couple of weeks ago, he decided to tell me why he didn't trust anybody and why it was so important to him to protect himself from what he saw. And it became a kind of a confession. And he dished it out. I was there from about 9:30 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon. And he first told me a little bit. And then he waited to see if I got up and left. I don't know. And then a little later, he told me a little more. And a little later, he told me a little more. And then he was almost in tears. Now, this guy is a tough guy. And what he told me is, you know, this is a hell of a time of my life to develop a conscience. Because it was that barrier I had around me that's kept me alive all this time. And I said to him, so what did you keep yourself alive for? And he looked at me and he had tears in his eyes, you know. And the issue for him is that he's waking up and he's beginning to feel this stuff, and it really hurts. It really hurts. All this stuff that he paid no attention to before because he couldn't feel it. I left there with my own pain. The pain that came from knowing that he had two choices. One was he could continue down that route he was going, which was to look at all of those things and feel them and feel all that pain, or he could go back to the way he was, a life that he knows how to live, but one that will surely send him back to prison. And you know, for a couple of days after that, I was really, I didn't know how to be. I did not know how to hold that pain, his pain, and my pain for him. I didn't know how to hold it. And so I thought about what that pain felt like in my body. What was that pain about? Was I feeling sorry for him? Was I feeling sorry for me? You know, what was that pain about? And what eventually happened is I realized that that pain had something to do with my own fears about not being free. My own fears about not having control over what happens in my life. My own fears about not knowing what the future was going to be. And that was really interesting. It was interesting to know that I could look at pain and find out all of this stuff about myself that wasn't accessible before, because I wasn't looking there for that. It just wasn't something I was thinking about. And so now I know more about me. I haven't solved Paul's problems. He hasn't solved his problems. I haven't even solved my problems. But I'm not suffering so much. And that's what I'd like to offer to you, is the opportunity to see something different. You know, the other thing, I'll tell you another story. When I was on retreat once, and I spent the first week of the retreat doing meditation. And I felt great. It was the end of the week. I was very calm. I felt so loving. Everything was golden. It was beautiful. I have to tell you, I was happy. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, arose this enormous anger. I was so angry. I've never been so angry. And I thought, what is this? Here I was, floating along, and all this love, and all of a sudden, enormous, horrible, ugly, painful anger. And it physically hurt me. I was in pain. And I thought, oh, great. Here I am. Scratched 6 years of psychotherapy. My life, you know, it was something that had happened 7 years before that I was angry about. And I was really angry. And so I was sitting there with that anger, wondering whether I have to leave the retreat, because I was a mess, you know. I was walking around in my room. Fortunately, I had a room by myself, and I was throwing pillows, marching around. What happened to all of that calm equanimity? I was really wrapped up in this, and I decided that it was a great opportunity to figure out something about anger. And I did. I learned a lot about anger. I learned that anger hurts even if you don't express it. And I realized that part of what had come up for me was this incident about which I was so angry was something that I felt was an injustice to me, which it surely was. But it's also true that at that time, I was very angry. And the people around me could feel that anger. And I didn't know they could feel that anger, because I needed the experience of feeling that anger myself to know that. And I learned a lot about anger. First of all, I learned it goes away. That was really great, because this was one of those times when I thought I was going to be angry forever. So the things that I learned were that I could sit with the anger, that anger was painful to those people around me. It helped me develop some compassion for people who are around me when I'm angry. It told me something about how anger felt in my body. So now I notice when I'm getting angry. And because I remember how painful that was, I'm able to look at that anger and say, do I really need to be angry now? Is this important? Is this important enough to cause pain? So it's given me a tool that I can use in my life. Really understanding how that anger feels in my body. Let me see how I'm doing on time here. Um, Another thing that happened to me just recently was a result of hospice work that I do. I volunteer at Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco, which is the indigent care hospital, and they have a 26-bed ward, which is a hospice unit. And I go there every Thursday. And just before my last retreat, the night before, I was sitting with a young man who was 37 years old, schizophrenic, and dying of AIDS. And he was dying. I was sitting by his bedside, and he had already gone into a coma so that I couldn't really communicate with him. Now, my own belief about death is that it's not necessarily the moment when someone takes their last breath. I think it's a much more fluid event than that. And so I believed that he knew I was there and that I could, that he would be aware of me. But what I didn't know is whether he wanted me there. He had been around the ward for quite a long time, and he avoided people all the time. He didn't really want to interact with them. So there I was, trying to accompany him in his last hours, not knowing whether he really wanted me there or whether he really just wanted to be alone. He was flailing his arms, all of his limbs about. He was very restless. He was very hot. He was sweating. And I would wipe his brow and wondered whether I should hold his hand. And sometimes I held his hand and sometimes I didn't. And it got to be 10 o'clock. It was time for me to go home. And I live up in Inverness, so it's like an hour and a half drive. And I thought, oh, man, I can't just leave this guy here. There's nobody here. So finally, I left because I needed to go home. And his parents arrived about midnight, and he died the next morning. So I went off into retreat, and I was thinking about him, and I was thinking about all that pain and all of that uncertainty and how terrible it was that he was all alone. And there were two or three other people, I don't need to tell you their stories, who were in the hospice that I also felt the same thing about. They were old and alone, and how sad this was. And as I was sitting in retreat, I finally realized that this was my own fear of dying old and alone that was causing my suffering. I have no idea how he felt or how these older women felt, whether they're even aware that they're old and alone. There's a lot of dementia. And I realized that all of that suffering that I went in with, oh, there's so much pain in the world, was all mine. It was all my own suffering. And it all had to do with my fear of dying old and alone. Now, the really interesting thing about that is that's an old fear. I don't think I even have that fear now. It's just something that was left over from my old belief system about death. I didn't want to grow old and alone. So the suffering was not only self-generated, but it was having to do with something I don't even believe anymore. It was just old stuff. Realizing that has made it a lot easier to go back into hospice and sit, talk with people, hold their hands, accompany them in their last hours or their last years. Some of them are there a long time. But it's created a lot of space and freedom. That's the advantage of being willing to look at that pain and hold it in your hand. Now, I said at the beginning that part of what's true is that pain and joy are actually very close together. And I truly believe that's the case, because I can tell you that my work at hospice has made me a much happier person. And one of the reasons is that when you're sitting with people who are dying, Everything is actually about life. It is very much about life. It's about what it does it mean to be alive. It's the intensity of the moment is very great. And it's quite beautiful. It's very connected to right now. And the truth is, life is only accessible in this moment. This moment. This moment. It's not accessible in the past. It's not accessible in the future. It's only accessible in this moment. So if that's the case, the way to live is to be aware of what's happening right now. This is a blessing. This is a blessing. It's quite wonderful. One of the nice things that happened to me recently is I was talking to my mother, and I was telling her, you know, things are going so great for me right now. I finally married the man that I've been living with for many, many, many years. After 18 years of being together, we decided to get married. We live in this beautiful place. We have a lot of things going for us right now. A lot of wonderful things have been happening. And I said, you know, because I believe in impermanence, I'm sitting around waiting for the other shoe to fall. And she said to me, have you ever considered that this is the other shoe? And frankly, I had not. But what a wonderful idea. I mean, part of the problem about joy is that we so much don't expect it that we don't recognize it when it shows up. We're so sure that something bad is going to happen. We focus on the bad things because they're things we have to fix. Well, guess what? Pain you can't fix. Suffering you can do something about. Joy you don't have to fix either. You just have to notice it. You just have to notice it. You have to say, ah. And so the other thing I offer you, along with examining pain and noticing your pain and figuring it out, finding out what happens to you when you notice pain, is that you should notice joy. And the way to do that is to nurture that feeling in you by noticing it, even if it's just a little thing every day that you make sure you notice. Like, for example, if you like drinking coffee in the morning, noticing that first whiff of coffee and going, oh, does that smell great? Wow. It's almost a gratitude practice, you know? You just notice things that you like. We all have things that we like. You know, you can make lists. You can make three lists. One list is all of the things that I don't want in my life so that I can be happy. All of the things I want in my life so that I can be happy. Both of those lists have more to do with suffering than with pain or joy. But the third list is things in my life I already have that bring me joy. Now that's a great list. That's a list to nurture and cultivate. I'm going to read two things here. One is called An Autobiography in 5 Chapters. Chapter 1. I walk down the street. There's a big hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I am helpless. It takes forever to get out. Chapter 2. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in this same place, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3. I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see that it is there. I fall in. It's a habit, but my eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault. I get out immediately. Chapter 4. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. Chapter 5. I walk down a different street. That's what I hope for you, is that you find a different street. But you only go to a different street because you've examined that hole in the sidewalk more times than you care to examine it. You know that it's there. You know how it feels. You now know how to get out of it. And you don't need to fall into the hole anymore. You don't even need to walk around it. I'm going to read one more poem by Naomi. Let's see. Where is this poem? Here we go. It's called So Much Happiness. So much happiness. It's difficult to know what to do with so much happiness. With sadness, there's something to rub against, a wound to tend with lotion and cloth. When the world falls in around you, you have pieces to pick up, something to hold in your hands like ticket stubs or change. But happiness floats. It doesn't need you to hold it down. It doesn't need anything. Happiness lands on the roof of the next house singing and disappears when it wants to. You are happy either way. Even the fact that you once lived in a peaceful treehouse and now live over a quarry of noise and dust cannot make you unhappy. Everything has a life of its own. It too could wake up filled with possibilities of coffee cake and ripe peaches. And love even the floor which needs to be swept, the soiled linens and scratched records. Since there is no place large enough to contain so much happiness, you shrug, you raise your hands, and it flows out of you into everything you touch. You are not responsible. You take no credit, as the night sky takes no credit for the moon, but continues to hold it and share it, and in that way, be known. Thank you. We have a little time for questions or comments or ideas.
I have a general question about the talk, but I was just curious, what was your motivation to get involved with hospice?
My motivation to get involved with hospice. Well, let me tell you how that happened. I used to live here in this area, and I was a coordinator of Sangha Neighbors. And I had this long list of volunteers, people who were willing to help people out in crisis. I don't know whether all of you know about Sangha Neighbors here, but there is a volunteer group who is willing to help people out, visiting them in the hospital, doing babysitting so that you can run to a doctor's appointment, or picking something up at the grocery store, just things to help people when they're in need. And so I had this long list of volunteers, and I kept waiting for the phone to ring. Well, when the phone rang, it was always someone who really just wanted to talk. Nobody ever wanted soup. They wanted somebody to talk to. And I was very conscious of the fact that I really wasn't skilled at doing that. And so I decided to take the chaplaincy training that Sati Center offers. And one of the things that was required is that we do 150 volunteer hours of chaplaincy work. I had become interested in hospice, probably, 8 years ago or so. following a period when I was in very deep depression, and I took a year sort of examining things that I might do with my life that had more meaning for me than what I was doing, which was, you know, running around being an executive. And I felt very miserable, I might add. But, you know, it was the thing to do. And one of the things I did was go to a workshop on death and dying because I wanted to know something about that. And I was so impressed with the people that I heard speak. There was Rachel Remen, who is the medical director at Commonweal Cancer Help Program, which is where I am now also working. One of them was Charlie Garfield, who was the NASA engineer in charge of the lunar lander module. And after the moon landing, he quit NASA and got a PhD in psychology. And one of the things he did was start Shanti Project, which was the first volunteer group to work with AIDS patients. Joan Halifax, who had a lot of influence on me at that time also, was one of the speakers. And so I became very interested in that. So when I came up with this requirement to do that, I took the Zen Hospice training. And I think there was another also very long dormant factor, which was that my mother died of breast cancer when I was 12, and she spent the last 9 months of her life on a couch in the living room. She was 33 years old. And the night that she died, my father took her to the hospital. And so many times I've said, I don't know why he did that, but I actually do know why he did that. He was afraid, and he was trying to save her. But it didn't make any sense to me that she had to go there and die a few hours later. And so the idea of hospice, which is that that there's someone there to accompany you on that journey, appeals to my sense of rightness, how things should be. Death is a part of life. And I think in our culture, we treat death as a failure. Hello, I mean, this is what happens. But we tend to push it off in a dark corner and pretend that it doesn't happen. For myself, I think the experience of working at hospice has been so profound for me. My whole attitude about death has changed. And now I am much more curious about death. I want to be there for my death. That's the most important thing for me. I want to be there. So that's kind of a long answer to your question, but I don't think it's a simple answer. It's sort of a lot of things that have come together. I can tell you that the work at hospice is absolutely the best thing I've ever done in my life. Best thing I've ever done. And I mean that in terms of not only helping other people, but what it's done for me. I would also say that it was an outgrowth of what I call the bodhisattva impulse, which is from sitting on the cushion. At a certain point, it was no longer acceptable to me that all I did was hand people money. It had to be something I did that involved me in my life.